Guys, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you all. Please be seated. Good morning. Welcome again to the Bonneville County Courthouse. We're appreciative of the hospitality and welcoming we've received from the trial court administrator and others in the courthouse. We thank you for that. We're glad to be in Idaho Falls today, June 5th, 2024, for our second hearing for today in a matter entitled Wiseman versus Rencher. This is case number 50667, brought on appeal by Jacob and Jessica Wiseman, as well as WB, WK, and WN. They're represented on appeal by Nathan M. Olson. The respondent, Nathan Rencher, D.O., is represented by Kathy R. Silak. Counsel, do either of you have preliminary matters for the court prior to argument this morning?
No, Your Honor.
Very well, then. Mr. Olson, you may proceed, sir.
Chief Justice Bevin, honorable members of the Idaho Supreme Court, may it please the court. The appellant today, Jessica Wiseman and her four children, are here to challenge several decisions of the district court, and I'll take the next little opportunity here to address those issues, of course, that they've been covered in detail in our brief. Let me start first with the district court's granting of summary judgment. As well-established law, a summary judgment can only be granted if there is undisputed material facts that are admissible that warrant summary judgment. In this case, what we had was an advisory opinion that by law cannot be evidenced by both law and rule. Idaho Code 6-1004, Idaho Rules of Evidence 413, as well as 520. It's an advisory opinion in the medical screening panel that was issued even after the panel had jurisdiction, because by statute, this is Idaho Code 1009, after 90 days, the advisory panel is expired. It's not even an entity anymore, and this advisory opinion came after that. All of that is just in itself was inadmissible, should have never been considered by the district court. And then add to that that there are specific provisions in the statute, Idaho Code 6-1005, that prevents any decision from a medical advisory panel from being judicially reviewed, as well as causing any kind of prejudice whatsoever to the parties involved. The district court had to overlook this clear black letter law and rules in order to base this decision.
Let me stop you for just a minute. So I read your declaration that you submitted in support of the motion to disqualify Judge Boyce, and I know you're going to get to that issue. I have a question about one of the statements that's made in there. It's paragraph 9, and you say, I have intentionally not informed the Wisemans that this has occurred, instead first addressing the matter through the motion that has been filed to disqualify the presiding judge Pickett and have the offending pleadings completely removed. I don't know what this refers to. Are your clients aware that this case has been dismissed because of what occurred at the pre-litigation screening hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, they're sitting on the first row behind me.
Okay.
Now, let me explain why I put that in there. And that really had to do with, it really does have to do with the disqualification and trying to prevent the appearance of bias. When I filed the motion disqualified, wanted to give the judge chance to take care of this issue swiftly, and that way, without tainting the proceedings, tainting the Wiseman's perspective of the judge. I was doing everything I could to try to allow for a fair and impartial trial.
I don't understand why you were trying to protect the judge. Isn't your obligation to protect your client?
Yes. Well, when I say protect the judge, I was trying to protect the process. So that's protecting my client. I wasn't trying to protect the judge per se, but rather I was trying to protect the impartiality of the proceeding. And so,
why does your client have to be impartial? I assume most clients have a definite bias.
No, not the client, Your Honor. The court's impartiality. The court's impartiality.
So how does not advising your client what the court did affect the court's impartiality? I'm just not understanding this at all.
Yeah, Your Honor, look, this is a brief that was filed back at the beginning. I think I have to go back and think what I was thinking there. But really, I was trying to nip this in the bud. That's all. And of course, that did not happen. So at that point, I mean, it was not long after that, the Wisemans, I had to inform them what was going on. I was hoping that the judge would just simply reject the advisory opinion and we could just move on with the case.
So I guess I'm still a little bit unclear. What didn't you advise your client of? You said, I have intentionally not informed the Wisemans that this has occurred. What information did you keep from the Wisemans?
Only that, and this is only then, right, that this matters in the and opinions in the screening panel, which I had previously instructed them would be completely confidential and never come before a court of law, that had in fact happened. That's all I said. That's basically the reason, or that answers your question, I hope.
So if I'm reading you correctly, then what you're telling me is that you did not tell your clients at the time that you filed this motion to disqualify the judge that the other side had put the advisory opinion from the Med-Mal board into the record for the judge to see.
Yes, I think you made it very precise. That's exactly what happened there.
And tell me why you didn't tell your clients that this happened at that time.
And Your Honor, here's the thing. You're asking me all kind. You're asking about my client confidential communications, and if it's relevant, I guess I'll answer them. But
well, okay. Let me.
Do you want me to list all the times I met with my clients and what I said to them?
You submitted an affidavit to the court saying I've intentionally not informed the Wisemans that this has occurred. So I'm not asking for your confidential communications with your clients. I'm talking about the affidavit that you did file with the court, and I'm asking you about what you did. If I'm reading this correctly, I mean, this is a statement you made to the court. So, but ultimately, I mean, one of my questions is, and the reason that I brought this up is I want to make sure that your clients are fully informed about what's going on here, and the fact that I want to know, do you have any conflict of interest at this point in time representing the client in this proceeding where your conduct at this Med-Mal hearing is clearly at issue? Is there, I mean, do they fully understand this?
Your Honor, they're sitting behind me.
Okay.
And there has been discussion. And
that's all I need to know.
Okay.
That's all I need
to know. All right. At the end of the day, Your Honor, I mean, this is a jurisdictional issue. I mean, nothing should ever be discussed in a court of law about what happened at a medical screening panel, ever. There are two rules and a statute. There's no record. I had no ability to defend myself what happened at the hearing. This advisory opinion, which was a legal opinion, not something that the advisory panel had even any authority to do, is issue a legal opinion. the fact that that has been brought up, and here we are discussing it in front of the Idaho Supreme Court, that itself, it's unfair, it's prejudicial. It's prejudicial to the Wisemans. And, I mean, that goes to the reasons why Judge Pickett should be disqualified, in that he exceeded his jurisdiction. He exceeded his jurisdiction and decided to do his own substantive review of the screening panel statutes that he didn't have jurisdiction to do. He allowed extra judicial information to determine that was prejudicial to the Wisemans to determine his decision. And, I mean, this is, and I said this to Judge Pickett, this is absolutely nothing against Judge Pickett, personally. This is not. However, the court has a very important responsibility to preserve an impartial tribunal. And even the appearance of bias, even when there is an appearance of bias, a judge should disqualify him or herself.
Counsel, I understand your argument as to the, if you need a drink, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I understand your argument as to the admissibility. Mm-hmm. I don't understand your argument about why this requires us to remove Judge Pickett. Judges in trials of all types routinely have to discern between evidence that's admissible and evidence that's not admissible. Sometimes they even have to do it in camera, and they see evidence that the other side doesn't ever see. So just the fact that the judge viewed evidence that was ultimately inadmissible, why does that make him biased? Don't we assume that judges have the ability to filter out evidence that's not admissible?
Your Honor, I would agree if it were just, you know, reviewing something in chambers. I think, though, that really gets close to the line. I think where Judge Pickett went too far, though, is when he relied upon that in his decision. So he relied on extrajudicial, prejudicial information in his decision.
Well, the judge made an error of law.
Right.
And unfortunately, our judges, all of us, probably at one time or another made an error of law. But why should that rise to the level of saying he can't be fair and balanced and unbiased going forward in this case?
Well, this is where we get to the appearance of bias, because this advisory opinion, and I know that we have sealed much of that record, so I won't say what was in there. You've read what was in there. It was more than just a legal opinion. It was a fairly stern attack on me, and as well as my clients, but mostly me. And as I argued in our motion to disqualify, it kind of taints the proceedings. And so.
And my struggle with your argument, Mr. Olson, is then every single time we reverse one of our judges for an evidentiary ruling, according to your logic, we have to disqualify that judge and have the case reassigned because they admitted evidence that they shouldn't have admitted. And I'm just not understanding why we would do that.
This isn't just admitting evidence that they should have admitted. This is privileged information.
Right. And
it's privileged.
And that sometimes happens. Or it's right. 404B evidence in a criminal case, which can be evidence of another bad act or wrong. I mean, but our judges are equipped to make these decisions without being biased and without even the appearance of bias. They made a decision. That's it. And so I'm struggling because I still feel like under our law, you need to show something more than he read it and he made a decision. And I don't see anything more that indicates he's either biased towards you or your clients.
I'll mention one more thing and then I'll move on to the constitutionality in that regard. I think there is something more. I understand that the court has to make somewhat of a high bar for disqualification. I understand that. I do believe that there is something more. As I mentioned, there was the fact that it was privileged. And then from there on, I mean, for instance, Judge Pickett, not only when we moved to disqualify, Judge Pickett not only denied the motion, but then he made a ruling. He made a ruling on the admissibility of that advisory opinion. That motion wasn't even in front of him. And then...
So I don't understand what you mean, because you'd move to strike that from...
No, I moved to disqualify. I moved to strike it. But if you read his memorandum decision on the motion to strike, he said, go read my decision on the motion to disqualify. So we hadn't even moved to strike the opinion yet, and he allowed it in. And then also, what was interesting about the memorandum decision is this sua sponte deciding to conduct a judicial review of the Idaho Screening Panel Act. I mean, this case was not brought under the Idaho Screening Panel Act. It was brought under the Idaho statutes 6, 10, 12, 13. But the judge basically took it upon himself to conduct a review of that act, make substantive interpretations, and then he also cited the purpose. The purpose of that act is to discourage claimants from bringing medical malpractice cases. So now the judge is deciding that he has jurisdiction to make decisions as to whether plaintiffs should be discouraged from filing medical malpractice actions.
From what can we make the inference that the purpose of the act is to discourage plaintiffs from bringing claims?
It's right there in the purpose. I mean, this is...
I'm pretty sure it's not worded like that, is it?
It is. I'll bring it to you right now. In fact, he cited in his opinion, it's page 27 of the confidential court record that was submitted, I believe, by the defendant in this case. It's page 8 of his memorandum decision, dated dated November 7, 2022. The legislative intent of this statute is that it is in the public interest to encourage non-litigation of claims against physicians and hospitals. That's literally the purpose of the statute.
Non-litigation of claims doesn't mean that claims can't be brought. It just means that trying to resolve claims out of court.
I think the key word, Your Honor, Justice Mueller, is encourage. This statute is not, and this actually kind of gets into the constitutional issues that we raised. This is not an opportunity for mediation. It is not to prevent frivolous cases. Nothing in there about it. It is to encourage non-litigation. So in other words, it is in the public interest to discourage claimants from bringing malpractice claims. And so when Judge Pickett decides that he's going to do a statutory interpretation, he's now in the shoes of the public interest, trying to discourage, that supports discouraging medical malpractice suits. He's doing that at the same time he is supposed to be sitting as an impartial judge over the actual claims.
Rule 520 specifically references Idaho Code 16-1001 through 1011. Since the statute is mentioned in the rule, wouldn't it require the court to do some statutory analysis in analyzing the rule?
Well, Your Honor, he did more than that. I mean, the reason why he had to go the extent that he did was, it's a very unusual decision where he, first of all, inserts a term into the statute that doesn't exist, participation. He disregards the fact that he couldn't do any kind of judicial review. And then he says, well, because of this new term that I put into this statute, that's in conflict with Idaho Rule 520. And so when that happens, I pick the statute. So he literally found a conflict with his own inserted term into the statute and IRD to 520. So he wasn't using 520 as a basis for his decision that I have to review it under 520. He said there was a conflict because of this new term, and underlying it all was the judge and the court saying, relied upon the stated purpose of the statute, which is basically to discourage litigation, to protect hospitals and doctors. And I think that's where I think when we talk about something more of that, I would just urge the court to consider that and whether there can be confidence in an impartial tribunal upon the return of this case. So on the constitutional issues, Your Honor, and I think that'll go an extra couple minutes after my 20, I'm up to the 20, right? Okay. Your Honor, I understand that this is a, there have been constitutional challenges on other medical screening panels throughout the United States. I'd probably say the majority of them have upheld it, but then there have been some that have not. I think, Your Honor, as we mentioned in our brief, I think this is time for the court to review that statute as to whether it's constitutional or not, whether it violates the Equal Protection Clause or not, whether it violates Article 1, Section 18 of the Idaho Code, which gives a person a right to a speedy and non-prejudicial process, access to the courts. This statute really, I would urge, I think the court could grant the Wiseman's appeal without even addressing the constitutional issues, but I think it's time that it is, because this is a problematic statute for a lot of reasons. I can't get into all of them in the brief. A couple of points I will make, and that is that what kind of standard should apply? Should it be strict? Should it be the means test or intermediate scrutiny? And I think this court has already at least addressed that issue in its prior decisions. That's the LaPel decision. But on a means-focused test, you look at two things. One is where there is a discriminatory character of a classification of a statute, so a particular party or group. And then, and that's Jones v. State Board of Medicine.
Well, and it's not just discriminatory, right? It's invidiously discriminatory.
Yeah, it's invidiously. And
so, which is different than discriminating between two groups.
That's exactly where it was going. Okay. I wasn't going to ignore that. And in fact, since you mentioned, of course, that's the Planned Parenthood, the state. And really, we've laid this out in brief. I won't spend too much time on it, but we do cover it in detail. There really are two types of classifications here. One are the claimants, which would be the Wisemans and the doctor and anybody. Basically, the Wisemans are plaintiffs that have claims, and the doctor, Dr. Rencher, is a defendant who has claims as well, defending his conduct. Without question, the two groups in this particular statute are not on even par, not even close. The Wisemans, as plaintiffs wanting to bring a claim, have to go through this process, go through this delay, have to incur costs and expense, and here they are, having lost a husband and a father, making very serious allegations, which are allegations at this point, but if they're true, they're entitled to relief.
And so I want to be clear what the classification is that you're attacking, because in your opening brief, you framed it as the distinction between surgeons, physicians, surgical centers. They go through the pre-lit screening process, and other providers, such as the physical therapists, do not. And then I seemed to see in your reply brief that you were changing
your attack a little bit. And so can you tell me what is the classification that you're challenging?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's a very good point. And there's I'm looking for this Wyoming decision that lays those two categories out. And we referred this to this in our reply brief, but actually in our, I think, our opening brief as well. It's Boysher versus Saeed. Actually, this is a Rhode Island decision. It's on page 24 of her appellant's brief. Rhode Island made two distinctions. One is the medical malpractice claimants and tort plaintiffs, and that's what I referred to initially. And then also what you were alluding to, Justice Zahn, is certain defined medical tort features and other similarly situated field. That's where you have special treatment for doctors and, you know, medical doctors and acute care hospitals, but none of the other healthcare providers.
Right, and the Wyoming court in Holm applied rational basis. It didn't apply intermediate scrutiny.
I understand, and we made the argument for rational basis. I think in either way you cut it, I don't believe this is constitutional, but I think if the court takes a close review of this, this is really more of a means test because you are making classifications.
Right, but that's my point, Mr. Olson, is the fact that there's a classification doesn't make it means focus. It has to be invidiously discriminatory, right, or it has to be a classification designed to engender ill will or something more. Just a regular old difference in the way you treat two groups of people is rational basis. And so help me understand, because you've cited us to other cases, Bush or Holm, all of those analyze the distinction under rational basis. So what is the invidiously discriminatory classification you're attacking in your equal protection claim?
Let's go back to the purpose of the statute, discourage medical malpractices. Let's go. We also addressed in our brief the fact that really the defendant or the opposing party, the claim that's being brought against, has to do absolutely nothing. What if Dr. Rencher just doesn't show up at the screen? He doesn't have to do anything. All of the burden is on the plaintiff, the cost, the expense of going through this process, which also gives the defendant doctor an advantage in the case. They get information about the claim before it's filed. So I look at it, frankly, as really a way to try to discourage plaintiffs from bringing medical malpractice actions for the purposes, you know, even plaintiffs who've had a father die, and if their allegations are true, it's probably gross negligence, as compared to doctors and hospitals who are some of the most highest paid professionals in the entire state, saving some money on their medical malpractice insurance. That's what you're weighing. And I think if you look at it in that fashion, there is an equal protection issue, and there's also a prejudicial issue under Idaho Constitution 1, Section 18. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Mr. Wilson.
What's that?
You said very well. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel, and the parties, the Weissmans. My name is Kathy Silek. I'm appearing here today for the respondent, Nathan Rencher, D.O. The respondent here respectfully requests that the court would affirm the district court's memorandum decision and order granting Dr. Rencher's motion for summary judgment and dismissing the appellant's claims against him. We addressed seven issues in our brief on appeal, I probably will not get through all of those, but do reserve all of those on behalf of Dr. Rencher. I'll take these slightly out of order from what we had in our briefing, kind of trying to respond a little to the court's commentary and the argument of counsel. So the first issue I would like to address is the court's summary judgment decision, which is based upon the failure of the Weissman parties to comply with the compulsory pre-litigation screening panel hearing provided in Idaho Code Section 6-1001 and associated other statutes within that code section. The court correctly held that the Weissmans did not comply with that code section. And that code section's language makes clear that the panel proceedings are compulsory as a condition precedent to litigation. We've had some discussion here today about the intent of the statute when the legislature passed it in 1976. And that was indeed quoted in the district court's order that was referenced by counsel. And I'll just quote that again. The legislative intent of this statute is that it is, quote, in the public interest to encourage non-litigation of claims against physicians and hospitals by providing for pre-litigation screening of such claims by a hearing panel as provided in this act. And that's quoting from, as the district court did, he quoted from 1976 Idaho Session Laws, Chapter 278, Paragraph 1. And we have also cited that in our briefing as well. So this statute does not prevent the filing of even a complaint. This court's decision in Moss versus Bjornson from 1988 allowed for the filing of a complaint before the filing of the pre-litigation claim. That case is it's an older case, but nevertheless still has vitality. Indeed, in this very case, the Weissman parties did file their complaint ahead of filing a claim with the panel.
Counsel, help me understand when you talk about the compulsory language. I understand that. But what is compulsory? Beyond filing the claim before the pre-litigation screening panel, what else is compulsory in that statute of prospective plaintiffs?
The district court's summary judgment order addressed this very issue. The bottom line for this district court was evidence brought forth by the claimants, the plaintiffs. And we can see, for example, in this court's decision in James versus Buck from 1986, 111 Idaho 708, the purpose of the panel is, quote, to receive evidence concerning the plaintiff's claim. And the panel at the close of the proceedings is to, quote, provide the parties its comments and observations with respect to the dispute.
So these are informal proceedings, rules of evidence don't apply. So is the filing the claim itself a form of evidence?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the statute treats it in such a manner. The filing of the claim, which is done pursuant to Idaho State Board of Medicine protocols and forms, triggers or starts the entire process.
The reason I ask, because, as you know, in typical civil court, a verified complaint has evidentiary value. An unsworn complaint doesn't. But we're not applying those rules here. So if they set forth a complaint that lists the basics, doesn't that satisfy the present evidence requirement?
Your Honor, thank you very much for the question, because clearly it's a very important issue, and the district court addressed it. The statute gives guidance on this, because the statute describes the process as in the nature of a civil grand jury. The civil grand jury process would have to be more envisioned by our legislature as being more than the claim itself. If a verified complaint had already been filed in the district court, which under Moss, v. Bjornson is perfectly permissible under Idaho law, potentially a verified complaint could be brought forth at the hearing as the evidence. And again, of course, Your Honor is correct. The statute is clear about the, you know, the informality of the process. But it's also clear that the panel provides a very important function, which is that report. It can make recommendations. It even, in the statute itself, states that it can suggest an amount in damages, a monetary amount that could potentially assist these parties in their settlement. So Dr. Rencher submits that more is required than just the claim, which here was a short statement.
And counsel, my struggle is 6-1001 only says the proceedings are compulsory. It doesn't say participation is compulsory. And then 6-1005 says there shall be no judicial or other review or appeal of such matters. And it strikes me that the district court's decision is a review of the pre-litigation screening panel and what happened and counsel's conduct. And 6-1005 also says no party shall be, and I'm insert some ellipses, no party shall be affected or prejudiced by the proposals, conclusions, or suggestions of the panel or any member or segment thereof. And it appears the district court based its decision dismissing the case squarely on the statements by the pre-litigation screening panel in its report. And so help me understand how the district court could do anything it did under 6-1005, because it appears to say he doesn't get to look at that at all.
Thank you for those questions, Justice Zahn. This statute, again, 1001, as you point out, does have that compulsory language. But this code was passed in 1976 in response to the legislature's concern over a medical malpractice insurance crisis that was occurring in that era, in that period of time. And as our briefing points out, I think it's been pointed out, many states across the United States passed similar structures. So 1001 really cannot be read in isolation. And typically when courts are construing statutes, this court will look at the entirety of the statute as opposed to just words in isolation where there is perhaps some ambiguity. So we submit that if you look at all of the different sections that apply to the pre-litigation hearing process, it becomes clear that more than just the triggering or the starting, the claim initiating, more must occur. The civil grand jury, as I mentioned earlier, that puts a burden on the claiming party to come forward with some evidence, which could be the verified complaint. That is potentially true.
Right,
and here we had that.
But
yes,
when
please.
1005 says the court doesn't get to look at what happened and no party is going to be prejudiced by what happened, I mean,
yes,
how can he do this? How can he look at this?
So 1005, again, it goes to the function of the panel. And typically...
No, 1005 goes to the function of the court.
I'm sorry, the function of the court. The function of the panel, when it gets through with its hearing process, is to come up with its recommendations. The statute is contemplating substantive recommendations. Those are confidential. Those are not to be brought forth in court. They are not part of the record. There's no evidentiary record that's kept. These are informal proceedings. So what the district court did here, first of all, this advisory opinion, as you're well aware, was filed by my colleague, Mr. Gaviola, under seal. The district court did not consider the entirety of this, I believe it was a three-page advisory opinion. There are redacted portions in his decision that he looked at. those portions go not to any substance, not to the panel's function, which is providing those recommendations, those evaluations, again, designed to comply with the legislature's intent when it passed the statute. So what the judge did here was not to take into account anything substantive whatsoever. Those, any portions like that are redacted, not considered, set aside by this judge. And what he did was to take, you know, really just the sheer fact of whether anything in addition to the claim had been brought forth. That, so that is all that he did. And we submit that under rules of evidence, under this court's established precedents concerning any kind of conflict between rules of evidence and statutes, that in just this narrow instance, this judge could take those portions of the advisory opinion into account. They are, he's not reviewing them like an appellate court would review. What Judge Pickett did was to take more or less the factual statement of that advisory opinion. And that, when we think about this statute and we think about the compulsory nature of it in terms of their actually, of what 1001 states, it is hard to see how that becomes enforced. Does, other than having some statement that is reliable, and we do, we have an analysis of the hearsay exceptions, the judge went through these, to say what exactly happened.
Why can't you establish participation just through, say, Mr. Gaviola? Because, again, going back to 1001, it only says the proceedings are compulsory. And so let's assume, hypothetically, Mr. Gaviola files a motion and he says, there were no proceedings. And then Mr. Olson comes back and says, there were. And why isn't that enough? Or why isn't it a statement from the executive director of the Board of Medicine, yes, there were proceedings, or no, there weren't proceedings? Because when I read this act as a whole, what I see is this process, the proceedings are compulsory. The statute says, hey, Board of Medicine, this is how you're going to do this. This is what you should set up. This is what you should be prepared to do. This is who's on the panel. Court, you don't get to look at it at all. When I read the act as a whole, that's what I see. And 61005 in particular, when I read it, it says there is no judicial review of this at all. So beyond the fact of yes, a proceeding occurred or no, a proceeding didn't, why isn't that a reasonable reading of the act, as opposed to the court getting into reviewing what happened and deciding was it enough or not, which seems to be exactly what 61005 says the court can't do.
Thank you again for the question. Mr. Gaviola, of course, was not present during the presentation or the, this was done remotely. This was done in a virtual hearing. So Mr. Gaviola was not present. So any statement made by him would not have any foundation. The only way that he had knowledge of what transpired was from the advisory opinion. So because as these processes occur, unless there is a special ruling by the panel, the other party cannot attend the presentation. These are separate.
Right. And so to my point, why isn't, when you read the act as a whole, the salient point, did the Board of Medicine convene a panel and was there a proceeding or not? That's the end of the inquiry. And clearly Mr. Gaviola is going to know when he talks to his client, was there a proceeding or not? Or he can call the Board of Medicine, was there a proceeding or not? Why isn't that enough to satisfy the compulsory part of 6-1001? Why do we have to get into the sufficiency of the evidence presented and whether you did enough?
Your Honor, so Mr. Gaviola's client would have no additional knowledge beyond what counsel had, because again, the defense side, the plaintiff side and the defense side are completely separate. They are not in the same proceeding.
Right. My point is, though, the fact of the proceeding, one or both of them is going to know either there was a pre-lit or not.
Well, in this particular case, Mr. Gaviola only had the knowledge that the claimants had not gone forward based upon the advisory opinion. There is no other process that is available. There's no process for the panel itself to enforce the compulsory nature of it. So Mr. Gabbiola did the best he could by trying to present in a sealed record. He asked for this to be presented under seal. The judge granted that. This is still under seal here in the Supreme Court. There really is no, as I say, there's no other way to really know what happened, because again, they are separate. And when we get into the issue of the court review is more than just taking an advisory opinion and saying, here is a statement of fact that was laid out by this body, by the panel. And the statement was, this is what occurred or didn't occur. So the review, it's not as though Judge Pickett is questioning or analyzing this. It is as if a witness is testifying. It's not a review the way an appellate court would review or a district court might review a ruling of another court.
Right. No, you go ahead. What I'm getting at is, why does he get to look at the decision, the recommendation, at all? When I read this act as a whole, he doesn't get to look beyond, was there a pre-lit screening panel convened or not? Yes or no? That's it. And so why isn't that a reasonable reading of the act when, taken as a whole, it says the proceedings are compulsory, Board of Medicine, this is how you do them, court, you don't get to look at them?
Well, Justice Ahn, I would submit that the way... This might be an excellent rule for the State Board of Medicine to adopt. This is really a case of first impression. I don't think my colleague, Mr. Olson, or any of us in our firm have found any other cases of a similar nature. So in order for Mr. Gabbiola, as he should do for his client, Dr. Rencher, to say there's an essential portion of this case that has to be proved before we can proceed with litigation. The Moss case states that. Moss says you have to show that there was the pre-litigation hearing. But the complaint can be filed before. But litigation can't proceed unless there is the allegation that's unchallenged that this was complied with, that this statute was complied with. So this was the way, in this particular case, that it was available. But it does not betray 1005. The court's function is not beyond that, because that judge is not reviewing. In other words, he's not reviewing it to say, well, they should have said the claim had more merit than it did, or the amount that they suggested was wrong. Those types of things would never come to a judge. That type of substantive decision by a panel would never come to the court.
But you're saying this isn't contrary to the statute. It says no party shall be obliged to comply with or otherwise be affected or prejudiced by the proposals, conclusions, or suggestions of the panel. So, I mean, even if you just look at the unredacted portions of the pre-lit panel's decision, how can you conclude anything other than the Wisemans were prejudiced by the conclusions of that panel?
Again, Your Honor, I would go back to this court's time-honored methodology of interpreting statutes.
I'm not interpreting a statute. I'm asking you to apply it.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think it needs to be applied in the broader context, because those proposals and conclusions relate to the substantive process of the hearing panel, where they listen to evidence from both sides, they make a determination. The panels are composed, as we all know, of a lawyer, a physician. If it's a hospital, it's a different type of person. Here it was a physician, and a lay person. These people come together and they make proposals. For example, the amount of damages potentially could be, let's say, $100,000. They make suggestions. They may make suggestions about how the parties could potentially engage in settlement. So those are the substantive types of decisions by this hearing panel that should never be brought into court. They should never prejudice a party's case. the type of verbiage that we see in the advisory opinion, the redacted portion, really goes to establishing the fact of did the hearing occur. It doesn't go to the substance.
Let me stop you for just a minute. Mr. Olson makes the point, I can't defend myself against this opinion, against this decision. There's absolutely no record. Your client wasn't there. There's absolutely no record of the proceeding. It's not, the statutes prohibit the recording of the proceedings. And so here I am, I'm supposed to now do what in order to defend against it? I mean, how does that happen?
Yes, I think our district judge here expected that there would be declarations from Mr. Olson, that there would be affidavits, perhaps of his clients, who are present. So they could, and Mr. Olson did submit two different declarations in this matter. So yes, they had the possibility of contesting. They could have said, we put in our complaint, we verified our complaint, we put that in front of the panel. The complaint is extremely detailed. It's you know, it really goes through the facts, dates, it's got a lot of detail in it. It's more than just bare notice pleading. They could have put in affidavits saying, we were present on that Zoom call, as Mrs. Wiseman was, her adult son was present, counsel was present. They could have said, here's what we did, and we did this. This is what we did. And it did appear that Judge Pickett more or less expected that they might do that.
And I'm going to back up even more. I mean, if we talk about applying time-honored standards of this court in statutory interpretation, the statute certainly envisions the panel's going to receive evidence. It tells them, get ready, this is how you're going to do it. I can't find anything in the statute that requires the claimant to submit evidence beyond initiating the process by filing a complaint. And so I certainly understand what you're saying, that, you know, why would the Board of Medicine set up this process and envision a panel that's going to receive evidence and make recommendations without the presentation of any evidence by the claimant? But it's not there. It's not there. And so when I look at this act, I don't know what the legislature envisioned. I don't know if the legislature intended that the plaintiff or the claimant has to present evidence. Isn't that a problem or a gap that the legislature needs to fill instead of this court? Because if I apply time-honored standards of statutory interpretation, nowhere does this act require a claimant to present evidence. I just don't see it. In fact, the word participate only appears in one section of the statute, and it talks about the confidentiality of the proceedings and who gets to attend whose evidence.
Yeah, Your Honor, we're not claiming that the word participate is the key statement here. But reading this legislation as a whole, as it was adopted in 1976, it wasn't just adopted piece by piece by piece. It's a whole series of subsections. And, you know, it also includes, towards the tail end of it, it includes what has to be proved at trial. So here, the statute specifically talks about it shall be in the nature of a civil grand jury. So the civil grand jury, it would encompass evidence. It would encompass testimony, potentially. It could encompass things like medical records. As I've mentioned before, it could encompass the complaint. That civil grand jury statement was the guidance that our legislature gave to the Idaho State Board of Medicine and to these future panels as to how they would conduct the proceeding.
And why wasn't in the nature of a civil grand jury, why wasn't that denoting the confidentiality of the proceeding as opposed to mandating the presentation of evidence?
The confidentiality of the proceeding is key when the proceeding is leading to the recommendations of the panel that are substantive relating to the medical malpractice events and claims. That is where the confidentiality is utterly key. In a situation like this, that is not what our what the district judge did. He did not review. He did not rely upon any kind of substantive decision.
Right, that wasn't the point of my question. The point of my question, you're relying heavily on the civil, as I understand it, the civil grand jury language to say this is what compels them to present evidence. And my question is, why isn't it an indication that this is supposed to remain confidential as opposed to the claimant has to present evidence?
In the full context of this entire statute, it appears that it's more guidance than that, more than just confidentiality. It is relating to the manner of the presentation, not just how those findings are to remain confidential.
And my struggle with that is when the legislature means to say something, we presume they use words, they say things, they issue mandates, they issue directives all the time. And so I'm just struggling with reading so much into the language. This should be like a civil grand jury proceeding. If they wanted to impose a good faith participation requirement, they could have come out and said it, but they didn't.
Well, there are other places, though, Justice Zahn, in this statute other than the civil grand jury. For example, they talk about asking for special additional presentation, that the panel can do that. And so if you look at those words, that must mean that some basic presentation must be made if they can ask for additional special presentation.
Not only that, they have subpoena power.
They have subpoena power where the parties request them to issue subpoenas, and the parties must bear the expense of that. But yes, they do have subpoena power, but at parties' request, not as some kind of roving body that's inquisitorial. That is not their function.
So then if we impose a good faith participation requirement on the claimants, are we imposing the same requirement on the part of the physician or hospital?
Your Honor, Justice Brody, thank you very much. I believe that the statute has to have that mutuality of responsibility to achieve the legislative purpose and intent. The legislature was faced with a crisis, and what it relates to is the provision of medical care to the citizenry of our state. If doctors cannot afford medical malpractice insurance, they will flee the state. Many states were faced with this in the mid-1970s, and we have a rural state here. We want to be able to have physicians available. The legislature wanted to create a process, make it mandatory, make it compulsory, to try to say, can we get some of these settled early? It's like an early neutral evaluation that a court may order. It's like mandatory mediation that a court may order, but it's embodied in statute.
So how far does the good faith participation requirement go? So, for example, if a pre-lit panel recommends the settlement of a claim, and you indicated that they even go so far as to recommend dollar amounts, do courts evaluate a doctor's good faith consideration of those dollar settlements? Do we go that far?
Justice, I only have 15 seconds, but I will answer. Justice, that is not reviewable by a court. That is confidential. They are authorized, the panel is authorized by statute to potentially even give a dollar amount. It is right in the statute. But that would not be reviewable by a court under the statute. It could not be enforced by a court. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Madam Clerk,
Excuse
how much
me,
time?
I apologize very much. I was not able to get to all the other portions of my argument, so they are all reserved. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
3 minutes,
Mr. Wilson.
Your Honor, I'm going to take it right back to where we started, which is this was a case dismissed on summary judgment, which means you have to have admissible evidence, and it cannot be materially disputed. And at the crux, this advisory opinion, which under Idaho Code 6-10-11, was issued by a panel that was already, didn't even have jurisdiction as a citizen advisory panel. It was not admissible. And I think that Justice Miller, well, both of you, Justice Don, asked some good questions. Well, how do we make determinations about what is appropriate, what isn't? Did they do enough? Did they present enough evidence, given the fact that there are no rules of evidence involved? There are no specific procedures, and most importantly, it is not even judicially reviewable. This is referred to, it's a non-judicial process, and here we are in a court of law in front of the Idaho Supreme Court reviewing a process that is non-judicial. So if this appeal is denied, what this court is doing is going to open the door now for these proceedings, which are specifically protected by statute and two rules of evidence, from now coming in front of a court. And the question was asked, the district court, why aren't more declarations being put forth by Mr. Olson and his clients? Well, because by introducing this inadmissible advisory opinion and bringing the issue into the district court now, they're inviting me to have to violate those two privileges when I don't need to, and bring in information that is specifically protected. It's a very protected process. And I'll finish with two quick points. This is a question I asked Judge Pickett, which he did not have an answer to. I said, Your Honor, what if you find that there is a material disputed fact? Does this now become a question for the jury? Are we going to have to give the jury instructions to have them review the process of what occurred in the citizens advisory panel? And he really didn't have to answer that. And the last point I'll make is this has to do to the discussion about protecting doctors and the purpose of the statute. This court, the district court, has no jurisdiction in this case to protect doctors and hospitals from increased medical malpractice premiums. That's just not an issue in this case, and we need to stick to the issues. Thank you.
Thanks. Counsel, to each of you, thank you for your argument today. This matter is now under advisement. We will render a decision accordingly. We'll be in recess until approximately 11:20.
All rise, please.